What is it that makes us, as humans, different? Even, shall I say, better than monkeys? Well, if you've been watching the news lately, you might not think very much right now, but Charlie Darwin did say we came down from the same tree, so what is it that makes us different than our pesky primate cousins? Hello everybody, I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me today for Better Than Monkeys. Well, I like to think it's the arts and the sciences. It's our ability to create beautiful music, to write beautiful poems, to appreciate art and music. Our guest today on Better Than Monkeys is one of those artists creating beautiful music. With multiple Grammys, 6 Grammy nominations, 20 years as the music director of the Buffalo Philharmonic, she has a discography of over 115 titles with the Buffalo Phil, the London Symphony Orchestra, and others. She's been described as having Toscanini's tight control over an ensemble, Walter's affectionate balancing of inner voices, Stokowski's gutsy showmanship, and a controlled frenzy worthy of Bernstein. She's conducted orchestras around the world from Philadelphia to London, and her 1999 appointment as director of the Buffalo Philharmonic marked the first time a woman had been appointed to lead a major American ensemble. In March of 2019, today's guest was named Performance Today's Classical Woman of the Year, and she has appeared as a guest on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, CBS Sunday Morning, Charlie Rose, BBC Radio, PBS's Live from Lincoln Center, and more. Our guest today on Better Than Monkeys, the venerable Joanne Folletta. Interested in conducting, I read, since you were about 11 years old, that you started as a classical guitarist. What kind of piqued your interest into becoming a conductor of all things?
Well, I was very happy with the classical guitar, and I love the classical guitar. I still play. I've played all my life. But I started to go to orchestra concerts when I was about 9 or 10. And I remember one particular concert at Carnegie Hall, because we were living in Queens in New York City. And we went to Carnegie Hall, and I heard Beethoven's Symphony No. 6. Which I probably had never heard before. And I was amazed by it. I found out later that Leopold Stokowski was actually conducting it. I didn't know at that time. I mean, he was an older gentleman. And I remember at the end, he said to the audience, well, since you liked it so much, we will play the last movement again. And I just remember just being delighted that he was going to play this beautiful movement again. I don't know if my parents were as delighted. I think they wanted to go home. But I realized then that the orchestra was something very special, something about the group playing together, the team, you know, all focused on excellence, focused on beauty, and working together to make something so beautiful happen. And I knew how I felt when I left. I couldn't put it into words, I don't think, but I just felt better about being alive somehow, having heard that music.
So that piqued your interest. What did it set in motion? What did you need to accomplish in order to go from being an 11-year-old guitar player to conducting one of the world's finest orchestras? There's obviously a path, a direction you had to take. What was your next step after falling in love with conducting?
Well, I think that I somehow knew I had to be in the middle of it. I wonder why I didn't say to myself, wouldn't it be great to play the cello? Wouldn't it be wonderful to play that flute solo? I really wanted to be the person who, in a way, made it possible for everyone to play that way, to created the landscape of that sound and helped the musicians be excellent. So that was my goal. My parents were not musicians. They didn't know what a conductor did. I didn't know what a conductor did, but I had a very wonderful guitar teacher from Europe, and he started to talk to me more about that when he knew I was interested. He taught me harmony and theory and ear training along with my lessons. I began to read and buy scores and look at them and watch everything I could, go to every concert I could. And even after all that, I still didn't exactly know what a conductor did. And until I went to Manus, I went to the Manus College of Music, where I was a double major, classical guitar and conducting. And then I was able to actually be in front of a group of my friends, students there, and try to learn how one practices this mysterious art form and how you keep on growing. So It took a long time. I learned to play piano, and I practiced cello too. I learned cello so I could play in an orchestra, a local orchestra, and see what it was like to be on the inside of the orchestra too, because I knew that was important. And I was very lucky. I think I was just there at the right time at Manus, and they accepted me as a double major, and then I went to Juilliard as a conducting major. So I feel very fortunate, but it was all went back to that Beethoven 6 performance, I think. But I was already deeply in love with music. You know, I loved the guitar, and I loved music in general.
Well, you know, in the 1980s, when you were going through Manus and Juilliard, female conductors weren't that prevalent back in the 80s.
No,
so you must
weren't.
Have been a bit of an anomaly. So how did you find that you fit in? Were you ostracized, warmly accepted? Was everyone kind of impartial to having you in the conducting schools?
Well, I think people were a little confused at first. I mean, and even Manus, you know, in a very kind way, the teacher said to me, the conducting teacher said, there's never really been a number of women who've made a career as an orchestral conductor. So maybe you might want to think about it again, or maybe choral conducting or something else. But I was young, and I just was determined to be in the middle of that repertoire. I wasn't offended. I wasn't upset. I just said, no, this is what I love. I love the orchestral repertoire. And I think they saw how serious about it I was. And it was just the time that they could say, all right, we could try this. And I'm sure there were a lot of people skeptical about it, and I just feel fortunate that they were willing to give me the chance to train me, to start to think about how to be a conductor, how to learn to be a conductor. And the same with Juilliard. There really weren't a lot of women visible in the conducting world. I mean, there were pioneers like Sarah Caldwell and I'm trying to think of who else was around at that time. Eve Queller was conducting opera, as Sarah Caldwell was. There was Antonio Brico, who came from Europe and was working in Denver. But these people were really pioneers. I mean, they had to just push against a lot of resistance, and they were the ones who really laid the groundwork for us who are practicing now to be conductors.
Had your classmates known that there would be Grammys and more than 5 dozen albums on your resume by this point, do you think they would have taken a little different approach to how they dealt with you when you were in school?
Oh, you know, no one knew what was going to happen in the conducting world. I mean, there were still very rarely that you heard a piece by a woman composer. A lot of things have changed now, but then things were changing very slowly, and it's partly the way classical music is. It's a very traditional discipline, and we're always looking to the past. We're always studying music of the past, or at least then in my training. And I think when we look to the past, we saw male conductors, male composers, and male orchestra members, really. So I guess it wasn't a surprise that this was slow to open up, but it has. And I think today things are quite different.
You've taken Buffalo from being a very good regional orchestra to being a world-class orchestra in just about 20 years, right? You've been with Buffalo about 20 years this year, correct?
In fact, I'm celebrating my 20th anniversary this week. So,
wow, congratulations.
So I'm very happy about that. But certainly it wasn't me alone at all. I mean, the musicians were poised to really concentrate on being the best orchestra they could. They had an illustrious past.
Absolutely.
With music directors like Michael Tilson Thomas and Joseph Cripps, Lucas Foss, amazing, amazing conductors. So they had a very good pedigree, but they'd had, as many orchestras have had, serious financial difficulties and serious challenges in that way, but they never gave up. The city never gave up on them. So I came at exactly the right time. The board was energized to surround us with support, and these 20 years, we've really gone forward. When I came in, too, we started a relationship with Naxos in
right.
which we could make CDs, and that has really strengthened the orchestra a great deal and spread its voice really all over the world.
Oh, it absolutely has. As a matter of fact, I was talking about this with some friends just the other day, that Buffalo has done a great job of putting out stellar recording after stellar recording. And we were talking about what makes your recordings different than those of some of the other orchestras. And we got a little in depth on it, and we were looking back, and practically every young conductor, when they get in and they're starting their first set of recordings with an orchestra, they go right into the meaty stuff and they record all the Beethoven symphonies, or they go through all the Brahms. But you seem to pick a repertoire that really isn't over-recorded. You seem to pick a repertoire that's fresh and vibrant. And is that your doing, or is that Naxos giving you some direction that this is what they would like to see?
Well, they open the door to that, and you're right. I mean, we would usually see, you know, series after series of the Beethoven symphonies, and we'd refer to them by who the conductor was. But
right.
Naxos talked about looking in other directions, and so we talked a great deal about it, and I was always interested in finding pieces of the past that somehow had fallen through the cracks, were unjustly neglected, composers that somehow didn't make it to all of the history books and about music. So that was my mission, my personal mission, was to sort of track these composers and these pieces down and bring them to life. I was always interested in new music as well, contemporary music, but this was more a late Romantic period, late Romantic and early 20th century. So almost all of the CDs we've done for Naxos have been with people who are less played, Vitislav Novak or Doshnani, people like this, Marcel Tiberg. Again, they're not contemporary people, but they're people who have lived in the turn of the last century or early 20th century and just somehow were not really known that well. So it's a lot harder on the orchestra. I mean, they had to really study this music, and we had to make sure that we were creating an interpretation in some ways. The Marcel Tiberg symphonies had never been played. So we were playing them for the first time and correcting the parts and discovering them. So it was really a challenge for all of us, but we've grown enormously in doing that. And I'm so glad we did, because I think that now composers have come to light that were really languishing.
They have, and you've really filled a void in the discography of great symphonies. Some stuff that really needed to be heard that hasn't been heard. My friend Kenneth Woods, he's with the English String Orchestra now. They did a great job of recording the symphonies of Hans Gall. That's the only recordings I have in our entire library. It's wonderful when new, fresh material, even if it's not that new, becomes accessible to the public.
It's true. And sometimes it fills gaps in connecting composers that we know by being the glue in between them, the post-Strauss composer or someone who went beyond someone else, who prepared the way for someone. So it's interesting for people to have all of this readily accessible now.
You're listening to Better Than Monkeys from WQLN Radio. Can I ask you a question about orchestra personalities? because you've conducted dozens of orchestras, and you work with a number right now, and each orchestra has its own personality. And I'm a trumpet player, and I grew up in listening to fine orchestras. My trumpet teacher used to play with the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra, and I had a lot of exposure through college going to see great orchestras. We always categorize them by either who was playing in the orchestra, who is conducting, or their personality type. So, you know, we always knew Chicago would have a particular brass sound. We always knew that Pittsburgh would have a particular string sound. We always knew that New York under Lenny was just a vibrant, exciting orchestra to listen to. We also knew that Cleveland under Doshnani was a little better at interpreting certain styles of music than perhaps Cleveland under Zell. So each orchestra has its own personality. Does that personality come from the orchestra members, because there's so many, so how could they find a cohesive personality type? Or does that come from the conductor?
You know, I think it's a mix of several things. A lot of it does come from the orchestra members, because their approach to the sound that they make, for instance, sitting in the principal trumpet chair, as you would know, sitting in the principal trumpet chair, the sound that the trumpet envisions for him or herself is a sound that the orchestra hears all the time, very clearly. So it gets into their psyche. They begin to create their sound around that. An oboist can do the same thing. Or a leader in a string section who likes a very warm, rich sound and leads his section in that way, all of a sudden that's changing. The personality of the individual wind players is very important too, because they're always playing solos, and how they approach that with imagination, with color, with whimsy sometimes, changes the personality of the orchestra. So they do have a big impact on it. A conductor who works with an orchestra for a long time, of course, and likes a certain approach to sound and a certain kind of flexibility, or however, a certain rhythmic accuracy, whatever the conductor is really very keen on focusing on, does create a certain personality. And then the hall that the orchestra plays in defines them too. We play in Klein Hans Music Hall in Buffalo, which is a great hall, a very Scandinavian hall, but beautiful sound. And I think that the color of the orchestra in that hall has led them to really excel at late Romantic music, at music with a kind of deep bottom, with a low center of gravity, which they do very, very well. In another situation, in a different hall that maybe was bright and not as blending as Klein Hans, the orchestra might excel at music that sparkled in a way, that music that was rhythmically brilliant. So a lot depends on the place they play, and they play in it every day. So it starts to define what they sounded like. Just as people said, the Philadelphia Orchestra developed a great string sound because they played in the Academy of Music, which wasn't flattering to projecting string sound. So to make up for that, they played with enormous color and warmth. Individually, they did that, and they created the Philadelphia string sound.
Do you shy away from particular pieces of music knowing where you're going to be performing them?
Not really, because I think as music director, you need to make sure that the orchestra plays every style, and that we're offering that to our communities, that they can Mozart and they can hear a brand new piece composed in 2 years ago. So they need to do that. So you do mix them in. I think, of course, for the recordings, I've been very sensitive in picking repertoire where I think they have something very special to say. And that generally is in later music, late Romantic and beyond.
Well, you know, part of your job as the music director of any orchestra that you're working with is to pick music that you said it's important for the community to be exposed to. Who do you think are the most important or relevant composers of our time right now? Because we know many years ago, composers weren't always well accepted in their own period of time. It took a little while for audiences to warm up to their music. So who do you think now is a really quintessential, groundbreaking composer? Who should we be listening to?
Well, you know, there are so many that I almost hesitate to say names because I do a lot of new music. And, you know, of course, we look at somebody like John Adams, who's already established as someone who's going to be, you know, played in perpetuity. But there are a lot of younger people who are like Darren Hagen and Kenneth Fuchs and wonderful composers, Behzad Ranjbaran. I mean, I do these people all the time. I think they're fantastic. Oh, many, many women composers. I was talking yesterday about Caroline Shaw. Beautiful performances of women of, you know, who were really pressing against the glass ceiling too, like Ellen Zwillich and Joan Tower. There are so many new voices, so I hesitate to say too many because I don't want to leave anybody out. But I think we have a great variety of different personalities now in new music. But they have one thing in common, which I think is spectacular. They want to communicate with the audience. They're not composing in an ivory tower. They're not composing for themselves. They are composing to reach people. Now, that doesn't mean it's a romantic style or an impressionistic style. It's their own voice, but they are very focused on reaching the listener.
There's another kind of a connection here. You said that the composers are very concerned on reaching the listener. Well, I watched a TED Talk with the great Benjamin Zander. He was talking about the transformative power of classical music. And he has this one funny phrase where he says, "It's funny that the conductor plays no instrument, yet his picture is on the cover of every album." So when he sits... What was that?
No, I said, I know Ben. He is very funny.
He is very funny. But he said he knows that his job is to reach the musicians and get the best out of the musicians. And he said, you can tell when that's happening when you make eye contact and there's sparkle in their eyes. If their eyes aren't sparkling, he's not successful as a conductor, because then that's limiting their ability to speak to the audience. So how do you know when you're having a successful moment with the orchestra?
You know, when it strikes me that things are working is when I can sense that the musicians are playing with freedom, and that's very important to me. Even though the conductor is always a guide and the conductor is a frame and an enabler. I mean, someone who allows something to happen, helps something happen. But when the musicians seem to be playing with a kind of freedom and personality and personal interest in what they're doing, then I know that it's gone beyond that, that they're feeling guided, but they're also feeling that they can do what they want. They can express themselves. And when you imagine all of these people in an orchestra feeling that way, which is a very hard thing to accomplish, how amazing the music is. Ben would probably say the same thing. He's so wise about that.
It's a wonderful TED Talk if you get a chance to watch it sometime. You just mentioned there that your job is to let them have some freedom to really try to express themselves and just guide them along the way. Of course, you're going to have some drama from time to time where maybe you disagree with the musician. Leonard Bernstein has a number of wonderful videos floating around where he either got into it with a musician or a singer. Never becomes an argument, but it does become a little battle of personalities. You're working with 60 to 100 people. Do you find that you run into a battle of personalities from time to time, and you don't have to name names?
No. Well, you know, actually not exactly like that, but I think if a conductor is willing to really listen to the music, you can pick up a lot of hints from the musicians. If a trumpet player seems uncomfortable or the violin soloist seems uncomfortable, you know that either he or she's being pushed or held back. So you relax. I mean, you relax or you let them take the reins and see where they're going. So you can be constantly responding to what orchestras are doing, and they're talking to you all the time and without a word. They're giving you clues as to how they're feeling and how this works for them, and does this tempo work, or are they feeling overwhelmed by the sound of the trombones and can't play through that. So the more aware you can be of the musicians around you, their body language, their playing, the more you can leave room for them. And I think that expression for me is very important. Leave room for them to be who they are. And it's very important for me to let the orchestra play their Beethoven 5, not the one that I might have done 2 weeks ago with another orchestra. So I'm not coming like with a cookie cutter saying, okay, it goes like this. No, I mean, I have a very strong frame of my interpretation of the piece, but I want to leave room for them to make it theirs, for them to inform the interpretation. And you can only do that if you're willing to listen. If you're really willing to listen to how they're playing and their sense of freedom and their sense of comfort. No one plays well when they're uncomfortable or feeling maybe frightened even or worried or not able to settle into something. That's not their best playing. So I think you need to be, we try and develop that all our lives. I mean, I'm spending all of my life trying to understand what orchestras are telling me and leaving room for that voice, those voices.
Interacting with musicians on such a personal level, even if you're standing at the front of a 100-piece orchestra, you're still interacting very deeply with even the third chair players at the back of the hall. And over time, I read that you actually like to keep a diary of poems that you'd written and that you actually published this with little inspirational moments from your career. So why did you choose poetry to keep your journal instead of just journaling or blogging?
Well, and it was exactly that. It was a journal. You're right. I mean, I had never kept a diary as a young person. I thought, you know, these concerts are so precious to me. I'm going to forget about them. I want to write down what happened today in this Ravel piano concerto or what happened when we did Mahler 2. Of course, there was those big moments, you know, that you say, oh, I've got to remember this always. Right. And for me, rather than writing an essay about it, it made more sense to sort of put it in a kind of a free poem where the highlights of what happened were contained and I could always treasure them. And I really did it only for myself so that I would at some point in my life look back and say, oh, I remember that performance and I remember how I felt during that. And a friend of mine, a musician in the Virginia Symphony, convinced me to put them in a book and publish it because he said people who are in the audience or people who are not musicians want to know what musicians are thinking and feeling. They're curious about that. And he said, I think they'll be curious about how you were feeling during that Elgar Enigma variation. So that's what I did. And I'm glad I did, because I do remember now these performances, or these artists that I worked with, or members of the orchestra, whether it's our principal bassoon or principal horn or a second violin or the cymbal player. I mean, I have poems about several of people like that in the orchestra, because they all have something so special about them.
Well, you know, that's kind of my goal every day. I've got 4 hours of classical music on the radio every day here at WQLN Radio. And so I like to introduce pieces and outro pieces with a little bit of a personal anecdote, either about the composer, about the music, about the time it was written, maybe even some stuff from my own career, because I think that personal connection to the music and to the musicians is what's so important. Have you read the Leonard Bernstein letters?
I never have read that. No, I know that it was published, but I haven't read it.
They're brilliant insight into the mind of the composer. And I think a lot of times when we as musicians just get up on stage and play a piece of music and then walk away when it's over, we left something on the table. We bared our whole heart and soul, but we're leaving it 100% up to people to interpret what we've done. Sometimes a little explanation before or after goes a long way. And I think maybe something like your poems telling about your experiences and your feelings and your emotions during those performances is a great way to lend a little insight into something that people might not have experienced right there in the concert hall.
Well, and I'm very happy if that happens, because sometimes, you know, our audiences are very intelligent. I mean, they don't really need to read books and books about things, but sometimes just a thought or a sentence or two, as you say, you mentioned a very interesting point about something. It sets their imaginations working, and all of a sudden, they're hearing the piece in a completely different way. And that's magical. So that's what we hope that people... I'm always sad, you know, when people say, oh, I don't go to concerts because I don't know anything about music. And you don't need to know anything about music. I mean, music speaks to you anyway. But sometimes people do like to have a little extra insight into why the composer wrote it, what he was thinking, and how a musician feels playing it.
So you're a rock star of the classical music world. You've got dozens of recordings out there. You're highly in demand as a conductor. What do you do to defrost when it's all over and the pressure is off for just a little bit? Like Rosin Milanov from the Chautauqua Symphony Orchestra, he loves to cook. He's a wonderful chef. So what's your guilty pleasure?
He's a wonderful guy. Well, I love to read. I love to bike ride. That's really what I do. I try not to travel. You know, when I have a little time off, I try and just stay home and do those simple things like, you know, cooking meals at home, or, you know, reading in the afternoon, or I love to practice yoga. So it's a very, very simple life otherwise, because the rest of my life seems so public and so involved with so many people, which is very stimulating, but
can be overstimulating.
Being quiet is good too.
It is. Everybody looks for a moment of quiet when you're in the public.
Yeah.
Well, I've kept you for about half an hour now, so I really appreciate you taking some time to talk with us here on WQLN Radio. I know your schedule is so busy, but let me end with saying thank you so much for all the wonderful recordings we aren't getting anywhere else through our friends at Naxos and the Buffalo Phil. You've done a wonderful job of exposing us to an entire world of music we may not have heard in recordings before. And so thank you so much for that, and I look forward to bumping into you at Kleinahan's at some point in the near future.
Well, thank you so much, Brian. It was a great delight to talk to you.
And it was a great delight and true pleasure to spend half an hour speaking with the great Joanne Folletta here on Better Than Monkeys. I hope you enjoyed this podcast, and if you would like to hear more Better Than Monkeys podcasts, we have podcasts online right now featuring Wynton Marsalis, Cheetah Rivera, Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn, and so many more. You can find them at wqln.org/BTM. You can find WQLN podcasts on SoundCloud, and you can find more information about WQLN and all its insightful, educational, and entertaining programming by visiting us on the web at wqln.org. Again, I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for spending some time with us here on Better Than Monkeys. Better Than Monkeys, it's a production of WQLN Radio. If you'd like to find out more information on Joanne Folletta and her exciting career and follow along with her discography, well, you can find it on her webpage, joannefolletta.com, joannefalletta.com. And if you'd like more information on the Buffalo Philharmonic, well, you can find that too. It's easy. www.bpo.org. Again, I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for Better Than Monkeys.